ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 So continuing with the verse summary from 6.2 on verses 13 to 16, page 112. Leading demigods beginning with Brahma and Shiva, the ancient great sages born before Brahma's time, the lesser demigods and the demons, the Nagas and other reptilians, human beings, birds, animals, the planets, and other bodies in outer space, lightning, thunder, the different grades of superhuman, human, and non-human life, and all other varieties of living entities, are covered by the Mahapurush, and thus subject to his feature of time, past, present, and future. Yet he is situated beyond all material conception, in a form that does not exceed 9 inches. Nimesha, as Srila Prabhupada states in his purport to these verses, the form of the Lord addressed here is that of Paramatma, Kiradaksha Vishnu, the aspect of Aniruddha in the Vaikuntha Chaturvyuha. So what we're pointing out is that this time is affecting everyone. Because the tendency would be is that, okay, you know, maybe I'm affected by time now, but in the future I may not be, or by some arrangement I won't be. But we see that he's mentioning beginning with Brahma and Shiva, so you're not going to get any far back than that. And then demigods that are there before Narada's time, sages in that. All the demigods, the superhumans, regular humans, those less, everybody's affected. So time we're not going to get away from. Right? So time is Krishna, and we're not going to get away from Krishna, because everything is Krishna. That makes some sense? Like that. And Krishna is controlling all this in, you know, as Paramatma. Right? Brahma next glorifies the supremacy of the Lord and his realm by comparing him to the sun. The sun, like the Lord, expands his energies throughout the universe. Thus the Lord maintains everything by his immeasurable glories. He controls immortality and fearlessness. And he is transcendental to death and the fruit of actions of the material world. Deathlessness, fearlessness, and freedom from the anxieties of old age and disease exist in the spiritual kingdom, which is beyond the three higher planetary systems and the material coverings. This spiritual world, which consists of 3/4 of the Lord's energy, is especially meant for those who will never be reborn. Others who are attached to family life... Didn't we just read this? Yeah. Others who are attached to family life and who do not strictly follow celibacy vows must live within the three worlds, the three material worlds. By his energies, the Lord masters both nescience and true knowledge and controls both matter and devotional service. Although all cosmic phenomena spring from him, he is aloof from matter, like the sun is separate from its rays and heat. Right? So he's supreme, and he compares him like the sun. Because the sun, even though it's everything is living, is based on it. It's all expansion of the sun, and that is all his energy. But at the same time, the sun is separate. Does that make sense? It's an important part, because otherwise then the tendency will be to blame Krishna for things that go on. But that's why he's very clearly made two things. One is he's not affected by it, and two, he's not responsible for it. Right? It's his energy. Material energy is material energy. But because we want to enjoy it separately from him, therefore, then it's set up for that. So it's arranged for us, right? Like, you can't blame the state for the prison. Right? Can you blame the state, you know, for the prison? If they didn't make a prison, then the prisoners wouldn't be inside. No, it's because there are criminals, therefore there's a prison. Otherwise, it's just, you know, the energy of the state. You just live in the natural form, right? So he controls immortality and fearlessness. So immortality is means these two are connected. Immortality is that platform eternity, so that's your sat principle. Now when this becomes perverted, you get fearfulness. You get fear, right? Because existence, eternity means existence, right? So who you are, or that you exist. Does that make sense? So that you exist, that's sambandha. So then when that existence is doubted, then there's fear. Does that make sense? That's why you see in the Vedas, there's so much emphasis on understanding who you are. Because if you understand who you are, then you're not fearful. Right? So of course, for the materialist, if he has a clear picture of who he is, he's focused on all that. But still at the time of death or anything dangerous, they'll be fearful. Right? But they have enough identity to work on the gross platform. Right? Then things are prosperous. Right? You also were picking up the Yagi Kunda. Oh, you already adjusted your Yagya Kundanas. Okay. Does that make some sense? So, means we're dealing with an overlap here. One is that to function properly, you must have an identity. Right? So if we have our identity is that of Krishna consciousness, then we will function in the spiritual world. If it's material, we will function in the material platform. But in any case, to function, you must have an identity. You must know who you are, what you want, where are you going. Right? It's not enough just to exist. You know what I'm saying? Because if you say, well, I'm just existing, but what is that existence? Right? Isn't it? According to grammar, then you have your intransitive verb means existence. Right? It's some form of being. Right? Being is, you know, anything else other than being and is? There's a string of them, isn't there? Huh? Oh, then it goes into ditransitive and transitives. Okay. So, but you understand, exists, but exists in some form. Krishna is swimming, means the swimming Krishna exists. Does that make sense? So there's some form of it. So if there's no form, there is no action. There's no activity. So existence means something will be going on. Right? Does that make sense? If you're conscious. So then it's important that there's an identity. Right? And so then the Vedas are always talking about this self-realization. So for the mundaner, it simply means I am, you know, of this gender, I am of this age, I'm from this family, I'm of this nature, I have this particular inclination within Varnashram, therefore I will do this. Does that make some sense? Right? So even materially to function, then there has to be something. Like if I say, okay, it's time for lunch. So are you coming to lunch? Well, I don't know. Are you hungry? Well, I'm not sure. You want to eat? Well, I haven't really made up my mind yet. You know? So, are you going to go to the prasad hall? Well, I got to think about that. You know, is there going to be any eating going on? No. But, you know, it's, you're hungry, you know where the prasad hall is, the bell rings, and in, you know, half a second, you're there. Right? That means there's focus. You know, I am a hungry person. Right? And so then you're there. Does that make sense? So without an identity, you can't function. Right? So ego is important, but not false ego, right? Real ego. So therefore, immortality and fearlessness come when we understand I am servant of Krishna. As long as we think I am this body, the body is temporary, so therefore immortality is not there. And the soul then becomes disturbed because you lose one identity and then you have to start all over again with a new one. Does that make sense? You know, what would you think? Every day when you woke up, you looked different and, you know, you had a different identity. You know what I'm saying? Today you wake up, you know, you're 15 years old and, you know, you're, how you say, one of the
you know, run the ashram, and tomorrow you wake up and you're 3 years old, and you know, like that, and you got, you know, three heads or something. You know, I mean, it would be a little bit annoying. You know, the next day you wake up, you find out you're a cat. You know, and wait a minute here. You know, so you understand. So that's why fear is there, right? Because you don't actually know who you are. Right? Some basic thing, it's good enough, it works, you know? You know, so, but at some point the body ends, then fear comes because we don't know who we are. So you don't know what to do. Does that make sense? But if you know I am servant of Krishna, then you know what to do. You think of Krishna, you go back to Godhead. So there's no fear. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why these words, immortality and fearlessness, are important. Transcendental to death, you know, so that's immortality. Fruit of actions of the material world. Because fruit of action means you're doing it for yourself. And that self that you have identified is temporary. So it's material. But if you identify the self as the soul, servant of Krishna, then the actions that you do, if you understand I am servant of Krishna, the actions you do are for Krishna. Right? And the results of a servant's work go to the master. Does that make sense? Somebody's working in a shop, and there's some transaction, the shop makes money. Even though the servant is the one who was involved in the transaction, who gets the money? The servant or the master? Yeah. So we identify as servant of Krishna, actually, then all activity we do, are the result is Krishna. So there is no fruit of action. Does that make sense? And when we think, I am this body, therefore this body is doing the work, therefore the work, the result of the work goes to the body. Does that make sense?
Right. What is that distracted from our, distract our consciousness from our real identity?
What obstructs our consciousness from our real identity? Basically, the desire to be the controller and enjoyer. You know, whatever it is, if it's, you know, we get to use this pump or that locker, or, you know, I'm going to sit here, or, you know, someone else has got to serve, I'm not serving, or I get more, or I pick out all the cheese, or, you know, something like that. There's something that is important to us to establish our control, you know, or our enjoyment. So as soon as we give that up, that it's the service continues, enjoyment will be there, control will be there, but it's not ours. Right? It's just like you borrow somebody's bicycle and then you say, this is my bicycle? No. So you means so some will think, well, if I don't identify or like that, then I won't do anything. No, because it's someone else's bicycle. You know what I'm saying? So that means, and if you have a relationship with that person, so you'll take care of it. You'll probably take care of it better than it was yours. It's yours, you may do all kinds of stupid stuff, but it's someone else's. You know, if you're at least a little bit of a human elements there, then, you know, you'll be a little more careful of the other person's bicycle. Right? Yeah? Is that okay? Is that okay? Yeah. Anything else?
Brahma then describes his own birth from the lotus flower that grew from the navel of Lord Mahavishnu. At that time, he wished to perform a sacrifice, but he had no ingredients other than the bodily limbs of the great personality of Godhead. Are you sure we didn't read this? I guess we were kind of going through it. Nimisha, Brahma here speaks of the Virat Roop prior to Visarga, the secondary creation entrusted to Brahma by the Lord. Right? Brahma's duty is to create. The time for that duty begins in the early hours of his every morning. Because during every night of Brahma, the cosmos below the region of Satyaloka dissolves and is absorbed into the stem of his lotus seat that grew from the navel of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu. Before he can create, Brahma has to visualize by meditation the subtle forms of the living entities. But where are they? They are arrayed within the subtle Virat Roop that Lord Vishnu sustains through the night within his heart. Simply stated, during Brahma's day, after he has completed the Visarga, the universe is manifest as matter in two phases, shtula, physical, and linga, astral. What remains through Brahma's night is the Virat Roop, as represented in the subtlest forms, in the subtlest of subtle material nature. Therein the jivatmas are suspended in sushupti, dreamless sleep or coma. In this state, beyond even the workings of the mind, thinking, feeling, willing, the karmic proclivities of the jivas remain, but not as explicit bodies and minds as we know them. Their karmic proclivities are implicit or encoded within karanak dehas, or causal bodies, rooted in the Lord's sat manifestation, the significance of which is noted in a nimisha in the previous chapter. Karana dehas are the forms of jivas as they are conserved inside the body of Karana Dakshai Vishnu, whose original aspect is Lord Shankarshan, known as jiva. See Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila 541. Finer even than the linga sharir, the subtle body of our experience in which the three modes of nature are active, sattvagun acting as the mind, rajagun acting as the intelligence, and tamagun acting as the false ego. The karana deha has its form in mahat, the great causal truth beyond vikara, the transformations of consciousness affecting by the triguna and kala. For an outline of the levels of material conditioning, see Bhagavatam 2.2.17. Also in Bhagavatam 2.15.54, Narada teaches a similar gradation to Maharaj Yudhishthir. Srila Prabhupada translates pragya as the causal designation. It is higher than taijasa, the subtle designation. The jivas in that unmanifested condition of mahat are part and parcel of the universal form displayed within the Lord's own dream. Persons highly accomplished in the mysticism of Astanga Yoga, who know the separate causal identity from the subtle and gross coverings, can, while in deep trance, visualize the virat dreamed by Sri Vishnu within the sky of his heart. Brahma arranged the necessary ingredients and paraphernalia from the Lord's own body. Gradually, by invoking the demigod's names, he attained Vishnu, the ultimate goal. Brahma informs Narada the same sacrifice was later performed by 9 older brothers of Naradaji, who are exalted among demigods and sages. Thereafter, the sacrifice was performed by the Manus, the forefathers, the learned scholars, etc. In return, the Supreme Lord accepts the three modes of nature, so that the gross creation is nicely sustained until the night of Brahma falls. Yet, even as he supports the gross creation with his all-pervasive impersonal energies, the Supreme Lord feels no personal affinity for any of the gunas, not even the mode of goodness. The Lord is perfectly transcendental at all times, in all places, in all circumstances. It is by the Lord's will, Brahma explains, that I create, Lord Shiva destroys, and he himself as Vishnu maintains all. So I think, weren't we over to 6.3?
No.
We weren't. How far did we actually get? Are we, is this where we were moving? Yeah, I thought we read this. Oh well, whatever, we'll continue. So, so pointing out is that everything's controlled by these modes of nature. The karana sharir is just the identity that I am the, remember it said in the mahat, he's saying here the karana sharir is the same as in mahat. And in mahat, the living entity says, I am that, it is mine. Right, remember? So this is the concept that I am the controller and enjoyer. Does that make sense? So that's what's making things function. Then you have your specific how you want to control, how you want to enjoy. Does that make sense? Like you decide, I am hungry, I want to eat. Then the next thing is, what do you want to eat? Right? But if I bring an array of what is available to eat, but you're not hungry, you're not going to be interested, right? Does that make sense? So it's so therefore the material creation is dependent on the living entity thinking I am the controller and enjoyer. Then only the variety has meaning. Does that make sense? Because that's why then, like Krishna and the great sages, because they don't have an interest to enjoy the material energy. Therefore, even though there's a variety of things here to enjoy, there's no attraction. Does that make sense? If I'm not hungry, you can bring so many foods, I'm not interested. Does that make sense? But if I'm hungry, it's like you can bring anything, we'll eat it, right? Does that make some sense?
Okay. And then here is that whenever at the end of the day of Brahma, then everything winds back up and then again it's manifest. Right? So this is like his daily sadhana. Lord Brahma has to, you know, create the world. Right? Know it for certain, Brahma continues, that all is dependent on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because I, Brahma, have caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord Hari with great zeal, all I say has proved true. Nor is the progress of my mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter. Yet, although I am the great Brahma, perfect in many ways, still I cannot understand him, the source of my birth. Therefore I surrender unto his feet, which alone can deliver one from the miseries of repeated birth and death. What can others do when the Lord himself is unable to estimate his own limits? The greatest demigods cannot know him. What to speak of lesser demigods? Brahma then admits that the great demigods and sages of the universe, including himself, are covered by Maya. They perceive the cosmos only according to their individual ability. So what is there to say about their knowledge of the Supreme Lord in person as he is? Let us therefore offer our respectful obeisances unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He tells Narada, although we chant his glories, he can hardly be known as he is in fullness. Right? So he's saying because he's completely fixed in the Lord, therefore there's no material impediment for him. But at the same time, he points out that still he's covered by some illusion, because he can only perceive how much is there. So that illusion may be spiritual, may be material. But still, one cannot know the Lord. Does this make some sense? Yeah. Brahma narrates how that unborn supreme original personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, first expands as his plenary portion, Mahavishnu, Karano Daksha Vishnu, who then creates this manifested cosmos. The creation takes place in him, and the material substance and manifestations are thus also only himself. He maintains them for some time and absorbs them again into himself. The Lord has no material tinges. He is all-pervading. He is unrivaled. He can be known only when one is free from all material hankerings of the senses. Karana Dakshay Vishnu, the first incarnation, is the master of eternal time, space, cause and effects, mind, the elements, the material ego, the modes of nature, the senses, the Virat, Rupa, Garbha Dakshay Vishnu, and the sum total of all living beings. All the demigods, as well as other extraordinary beings, both good and bad, may appear to be the form of the Lord or the form of truth, but they are not. They are only a fragment of the transcendental potency of the Lord. 39:45. Just like it's a fraction, there may be a quality of, just like a drop of water, you know, may have the same qualities as that of as a great body of water, as the ocean. But you can't say this is the ocean. You know, you bring along your eyedropper and you have one drop of water and you go, see, I got the ocean. You know? Everyone will say you're foolish. Right? So the idea is that they're only a portion, a very small fragment like that, even no matter how great they are. Krishna is unlimited, everybody else is not. Does that make sense? Yeah. And then again we see this point, no material tinges, because how he does things is perfect. There's something about it that's transcendental. But we know we're not, so therefore we don't copy, but we have faith in and follow the direction of the Lord. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Brahmadeva announces his desire to narrate the pastimes of the Leela avatars. He ends this chapter glorifying the process of hearing about these incarnations. Hearing of their activities counteracts all foul matters accumulated in the ear. These pastimes are pleasing to hear and are to be relished. Therefore, they are in my heart. Okay, so by hearing about the Lord, then all impure things that are there from hearing become purified. Right? We hear, and we hear something, and then from that, the mind gets interested, it gets distracted, it wants to do something. Right? We hear a loud noise, and oh, what's that? We have to know, we want to go see. Right? So, whatever has been heard that is unimportant, then by hearing the Lord's pastimes, that's all cleared away. Right? Then the heart becomes clean. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yes.
I had a question from the previous paragraph.
Huh.
And the other day you mentioned that in the spiritual world that Krishna put the jivas into, he covers them so that he can have his pastime.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's by Krishna's desire that we're bewildered in the spiritual world. It's Krishna is covering us rather than it being our desires to be in illusion.
What is that in reference to?
It
means you're talking about the spiritual being covered by yoga maya?
Yeah, when you were saying that like Brahma and Shiva, they're still covered.
No, but still there's something there. It means Brahma, means here when we're talking about Brahma and Shiva, then Brahma is a demigod, he's a jiva. So then, but he's the most pious living entity in the universe. And so ideally then he's a good devotee, but he may not be, just as most pious. So then there is some covering by Maya because he has the desire to create. So to be the, you know, how you say, the receptacle of that, of the Lord's creative potency. Right? So, but he's doing that all for the Lord and everything like that, but he still has the desire for that. So it's still the motive passion is there. That's why he said that. Shiva, then, who are we saying he's covered by illusory energy? That we're talking about, I say, Shambhu, means within the material world. But Sadashiva, which is the Lord's mood of I am the destroyer, that is not covered by illusion. You know what I'm saying? Means yoga maya is always at work, but you know, because you know, means there's a certain amount that every living entity can understand or penetrate. So we see that Krishna's illusory potency then can cover Balaram, so he can't tell what Krishna is doing.
In the spiritual world, or manifesting as
means
wherever.
I mean, Krishna and Balaram are always in the spiritual world. Wherever they go, it is.
So it's the transformation of our desires transferred to Krishna's desire that takes us into the Lord's eternal pastimes, but we're still covered.
Means one has to be covered. Means it's just like this. Krishna is God, because source of everything. How is he going to interact with all his energies in that mood? So that's the meaning of yoga maya. It's not an illusion. It's a covering to enhance the rasa.
But that covering comes at that point. It comes from Krishna because of Krishna's desire for rasa. Whereas at this point in our material bodies, it's our desire.
It's our desire, so it's mahamaya.
Yeah.
No, but it has to be our desire also.
In a spiritual world.
Yeah, because rasa means that you have the ashray and the vishay. The Vishay means the enjoyer, so that's Krishna. The Ashray means the one who is the shelter for a particular kind of affection for Krishna. Right? Because Rasa means the living entity is in a Rasa with Krishna, but Krishna's not in a Rasa, he is Rasa. You understand? So Mother Yashoda means she wants to serve Krishna as his mother, right? And so then Krishna then reciprocates that rasa with her and acts like her son, right? So it's based on the desire of the living entity. That's why independence, the free will, is so important.
So it's like out of the spiritual world, it's our
desires to control and enjoy, so it manifests in a gross way, but that's what was talking about the Karana Sharir, that concept that of I and mine being perverted, that I'm God, I'm the controller, I'm the enjoyer.
Okay. So it's when that flips, then.
Yeah, then you get Mahamaya.
Yeah.
But if it's I am servant of Krishna, I am, you know, to give pleasure to Krishna, then you're dealing with Yoga Maya. Right? Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, anything else on this? No. Okay, then 6.3, Vritti, commentary with Anuman, reasoning. The philosophy at the heart of chapter 6. Great sages, what to speak of ordinary scholars, have since time immemorial disputed as to whether the supreme absolute truth presented in the Vedic scriptures has form or is formless. Both sides of the dispute, the personalist versus the impersonalist, arm themselves with Shastra quotations that seem to validate their standpoints. In his purport to verse 10, Srila Prabhupada makes crystal clear the conclusion of the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya about the issue. On the contrary, the perfect description of the Lord holds that he is both impersonal and personal simultaneously. The personality of Godhead is the original feature of the Lord, and his impersonal emanation is but the reflection of his transcendental body. Those who are fortunate enough to have a view of the Lord from the front can realize his personal feature, whereas those who are frustrated and are thus kept on the ignorant side of the Lord, or in other words, those who have the view of the Lord from his back, realize him in his impersonal feature. Interesting. Yeah. Okay, because both exist means he is existence. So the form of the person that exists and the existence itself. Does that make sense? But in this case, Prabhupada points out it's the person that is first. Right? Because existence manifests from this person. So, Prabhupada points out that Krishna is beyond spiritual. Right? Does that make sense? Spiritual is our conception that it's not material. Right? And spiritual meaning everything expanded from Krishna that is not material. Does that make sense? Right? When we say it's spiritual, means it's not from here, it's from, you know, the spiritual realm. So that spiritual realm is what you say is spiritual. But Krishna is the source of that, so he has to be beyond spiritual. Does that make sense? So that's the point. He's something else. Like that. The Virat Purush described in this chapter is not the original transcendental form of Godhead. But all features displayed by the Virat are indeed exhibitions of the Supreme's transcendental potency that are displayed by him within the experience of universal knowledge. Okay? Does that make sense? It's not him. It's not his original form. But whatever's in the Virat Roop is manifestations of Krishna's energy. Yes?
That last statement, Maharaj. Could the Mayavadis be inspired to say that it's not just Krishna you have to surrender, but to the unborn within Krishna?
But then you're separated. That the unborn, that means there's an inside and an outside. Right? But the point is God is God. He is existence. It's not there's existence and then there's inside existence. You know? It goes together. That's just, they try to finagle it, you know, once, if all things point out, they're trying to prove the impersonal. And then if all the personal things are presented strongly, then they don't have an answer, then they'll come up with something great like this, right? Because it doesn't make sense. But the mind which wants to accept that impersonal is the path and personal is not, then immediately will be satisfied, so you accept it. Right? Because attachment takes one beyond reason. Does that make sense? So the Mayavadis are attached to the idea of becoming God. So because of this, then they will actually make unreasonable conclusions because of that attachment. Their attachment makes them lose their reason on this point. They may be very intelligent and correct in their, the workings of the material world, the position of various things in society, what is important, what's not, their view on materialism or material endeavor, fruit of activities, the Shastra, all these things may be very correct, they may be very clear. But when it comes to this point about the ultimate goal of liberation, right, because that's one of the points that the Upanishads establish, right, it means the Upanishads establish what is the form of God, right, what is the form of the Jiva, what is the material energy, right? Then the next is, what is the relationship between all these things, and the process of, that would be the first one. That means, chit achit ishwar, in other words, God, the soul, and the material energy, and what's their relation, right? Prabhupada mentioned from the Gita that this is knowledge, right? Because this is sambandha jnana. So those three are there. Then the abhideya, the fourth point made by the Upanishads, is the process to extract yourself from the control of this material energy, the material consciousness, right? And then the fifth point is then discussion on what is the position of the soul once it has been liberated. You understand? So, therefore, the impersonalist will say that, God is impersonal, and the jiva upon liberation is impersonal, right? So they'll get this first and this, fifth wrong. Also, the second is that, well, actually, they get a lot of it wrong. Then the second is the jiva, but they'll take jiva is God rather than jiva is just always that big. And the material energy, they'll say, doesn't exist, right? Rather than it's just another form of Krishna's energy, like we are. We're a form, so that's also a form. Inferior, but it's a form. So then, and then the process basically to get out of the material world for them and ourselves is pretty similar. Because basically you're performing activities out of duty without a desire for the result. That will take you out, right? Because Sudarshan is time, he destroys. So if you're functioning not on the material platform, then the time will destroy the material concept. Does that make sense? You're moving, but movement must be there. So if your movement is not material, then what else can it be? Right? It has to be spiritual. So here, spiritual meaning Brahman platform. So the Naishkarmya technically is the platform of Brahman if it's used properly. Right? So that will take you out of the material energy. That's why Krishna says it's not enough to just do your duty without attachment. You have to do it for him, thinking of him. Right? Because if you do it for him, that's also nice that it's devotional service in that way. But if you're not thinking of the person you're doing it for, then what will be the quality of that devotion? Does that make sense? So if that's there, it increases it. It makes it better. Yes? No? Like that? Yes?
You're dealing with the technicalities of your duty, and sometimes you're absorbed in that. How do you simultaneously think of Krishna?
How you simultaneously... It means there'll be moments. It means while you're actually focusing on the service, you'll be thinking of the service. But underlying that, there's a mood. Right? There's a feeling of just what it's being done for, Does that make sense? So if it's been done for Krishna, then that mood will have one flavor. Well, if it's done for ourselves, it'll have another flavor. Or for another mundane person, another flavor. Right? Does that make sense? So, but in between, there is thinking of Krishna. Right? You want to do this to please Krishna, as a person. Otherwise, you get this example of the... In Puri, then one pujari, his duty was bringing bathing water for the Lord, and so he did that perfectly every day. His whole life he brought that water. So at the time of death, he thought, "Oh, who's going to bring the water?" He didn't think of Krishna. He didn't think of Jagannath. like that, you know. So he was thinking nicely of his service and how to make his service perfect, but he never actually thought really who he was doing it for. Does that make sense? So one wants to avoid that. So that's why you know who you're working for, like that. But when you're technically involved in something, then you're doing that. Yeah.
So is that the whole life in vain? Not thinking about.
Is the whole life in vain? No, because one has done, you know, how you say service, but it'll be more along the line of agyata sukriti. But you know, it's service. It's not lost, but it's not enough to actually establish our relationship solidly with Krishna. You know, it's just like this. You're working so hard, doing something for somebody, and then if that somebody comes, you kind of just kind of, you know, be real formal and kind of avoid interaction. You know, then that other person will think, so much nice service they've done, why are they avoiding me? You know what I'm saying? Because then it's based on more that it's good and it's nice, so it's kind of more like a pious activity, though it's connected with the Lord. Otherwise, why would you be doing it? If you're not doing it for a person, you're doing it because it's good or right. Right? But, you know, in devotional service, we know who that person is. You know, what ultimate good is. Does that make sense? Yeah? It is important to catch an essential point that Srila Prabhupada makes in this purport and elsewhere. The personality of Godhead is the original feature of the Lord, and his impersonal emanation is but a reflection of his transcendental body. Here, hence, even the impersonal feature of the Absolute is not without form. Srila Prabhupada remarks, he is never a formless void. Earlier in the same purport, the Virat Purush is the impersonal feature of Godhead in the Vyakta, or material manifestation. Its Avyakta, unmanifest state, which the Mayavadis wrongly conclude is the original transcendental Brahman, is simply the same Virat in potential. Since a cloud in the sky is no less than a visible body of fine water droplets suspended in the atmosphere, how can a cloud be anything else than the potential for rain? Potential means that the transcendental potency evident in his reflected feature within the universal knowledge remains a reality, whether or not as perceived by our mundane senses. During the night of Brahma, when the outward features of the Virat are withdrawn into the stem of the Garbhodak lotus, or after Brahma's death in the period of Mahapralaya, dissolution of all the universes into the body of Mahavishnu, that potency is conserved by the Lord. It is hidden, never destroyed, and remanifested in due course. The Virat's continual existence cannot be reduced to zero by mental speculation. So pointing out is that he's making the point that even the impersonal, or the impersonal form, or the impersonal feature is not formless, because it's the potential of. Does that make sense? The form exists, just like you have a bag of flour, right? But within that bag of flour exists the potential form of a chapati. Does that make sense? Otherwise, how would it manifest? Does that make sense?
Yes.
So that's what he's making, is that the universal form, we say it's the manifestation of that impersonal feature. I mean, it's not Krishna, it's the impersonal feature of Godhead. But we see it has form. But impersonal meaning that you don't really have a relationship with it. Right? You're not devotee of Virat Rup. You notice that there is something superior, that there's a connection to God there, but the point is it should be that you're relating to the person. Does that make any sense? Yeah? So, yeah. Okay? So there's no such thing as no form. Right? Because everything in this material world is expanding from the Brahman. Right? We know, we see, just like we say, it's all coming from the sun, because the sun is a reflection of the Brahman. So all life is maintained by it. All life is manifest by it. So this sun, I said, yeah. So there is no such thing. That's why it's in purport in the second canto here. Then Prabhupada says that the concept of Brahman as, you know, just the impersonal, you know, I say Brahman realization, Paramatma realization. These are technically concepts of the material world. Right? They're not material, but they're perceptions that you only find in the material world. In the spiritual world, they're not absorbed in Brahman or Paramatma. They're absorbed in Bhagavan. Here, it's used as stages to get out of the material world and go back to Godhead. Does that make some sense? Yeah. So we're just trying to make the point is that this impersonal concept, meaning no relationship, I mean, meaning nothing, doesn't exist. That's why Shankara's philosophy is covered Buddhism, because it's just void, no form. But that's not the personal conception. Here we say impersonal, meaning unmanifest. Therefore, the relationship is not. There's no relationship. Does that make sense? Even though Shastra admits that the Virat exists in mental speculation only, Srimad Bhagavatam 3529 purport, there is still no doubt objectivity to its existence. Lord Mahavishnu makes the Virat manifest in the external world and unmanifest within his heart, mind. Just as when we are awake, we perceive the world around us via the external Gyanindriyas. But in sleep, we perceive the world inside us, in our minds, the location of the mind being the heart. At different time of night, our hearts play a host to dreams, swapnas, and dreamless slumber, shushupti. Because the Virat is first conceived in the macrocosm, mind of the Lord, Brahmadeva and other Paramatma realized saints and sages are able to perceive it within their microcosmic hearts and minds by mystic yoga. The testimony of Brahma is defined as Shruti, Srila Prabhupada's Morning Walk, Nellore, 6th January 1975. Hence, the description of the Virat Purusha in this chapter is to be accepted by us as authentic, objective, and scientific Vedic knowledge. Because what's coming from, knowledge coming from Brahma, that's Shruti. Because it's revealed. Means the Lord is thinking like this. So what he thinks comes to pass. He's Satya Sankalpa. Whatever he desires happens. Whatever he thinks happens. But it's unmanifest. Means we can't see it, but the great sages, by their meditation on the Lord, can perceive that unmanifest form. Does that make sense? And then they're able to describe or manifest that. So because it's directly dealing with the Lord there is Shruti, not Smriti. Yeah? No? Nimisha, Chandogya Upanishad 118 tells of a small sky within a lotus palace located in a great city, Daharosmin Antarakash, right? The city, they're talking about the heart, this is all. Explaining this, Srila Baladeva Vidyabhushan states in Govinda Bhasya, see his commentary on Vedanta Sutra 1314, that the great city is the body of a worshipper, the Lord. The lotus palace is his heart. Is the heart, and the small sky is the supersoul. The human body then is a microcosm. The small sky or space in the core of the human heart is no different from the vast sky above our heads, because in both the Lord's subtle Virat Rupa is displayed. This is why Bhagavatam 3.5.6 depicts his act of expanding into the universe thus.
Without any endeavor, the Supreme Lord lies down on his own heart spread in the form of the sky. Right? You have to lay down. He is existence. So he lies down, right, on the sky, but which is actually just his own mind, his own heart. Does that make sense? Because otherwise one would say, well, Mahavishnu, he's got to be lying on something, right? Or if you say, on the causal ocean, what's the causal ocean being held up by? It's just his own mind. Okay. It says here, without endeavor, right? He doesn't have to, you know, think and meditate and, you know, draw the energies and do all that. He just automatically just does it with no problem. Does that make sense? So he being existence, therefore he can, you know, lay down on himself. So it's his contemplation that is the unlimited. Right? So it all has form. It was unmanifest. Then when he desires to manifest it, then you see it. But it's still the same existence, is still the same person. Yes, no?
Yeah.
Fun, no?
It is.
Okay, any questions or anything on this, or?
Is the inconceivable part.
Yeah, this is the Achintya Bheda Abheda Tattva, inconceivable one and different. You just have to understand that. You know, have to accept it. I mean, intelligently it can be pointed out, but still one has to accept. Because, you know, he is existence, that means the ability to be, means you stand on existence, right? The floor exists, therefore you can stand on it. Does that make sense? So he is existence. So existence is there, therefore you can stand on it. And since in the beginning there's only him, so here he can stand on himself. Or in this case, he lies down on himself. That's why he's God. He's beyond what we can understand. Right? He's not, we're energy, so we can't understand the energetic. Right? Like that. There's no need, because understanding doesn't create necessarily rasa. Right? Maybe appreciation, but not rasa. Right? Rasa is then attachment. So that's more important. So that's where he doesn't understand us. You know? It means he understands, but I'm talking about as far as the experience goes. Does that make sense? Because he's not dependent; he's independent. So, what is the experience of the dependent? That's what he comes as Lord Chaitanya to taste. Right? Does that make sense? I mean, you know, it means he can understand, but the experience, because it's different. So we can't, so that's the difference. That's why Prabhupada says man can never understand woman can never understand man, because it's that way right from the origin. You know?
How does Lord Chaitanya take on that mood? And
how does Lord Chaitanya take on that mood?
It's real. And it's not.
Because he's non-different from his energy. So, being energetic, your perspective is that of the energetic, right? So, but because the energy is him, if he wants, he can take on the perspective of the energetic. I mean, of the energy. But the energy can't understand the energetic in that way. Does that make sense? But there's no need to. Right? Because he is everything, therefore there's the interest. Because we're not everything, therefore there's no need. You know, we try it. You know, when he does it, it comes out really nice. Lord Chaitanya. When we do it, it comes out as Maya. You know? Like that.
You know. Trying to understand the energetic also restores the rasa.
Trying to understand. Means
Yeah,
it's over-endeavoring.
Yeah, it means you try to understand only in as much to create relationship. Once relationship is understood, then you act within that relationship.
That's where the surrender comes.
Yes, yeah, surrender. Does that make sense? Yeah, it means the knowledge is important just to establish rasa, but in the rasa, that's accepted, and that's how it functions. Right? It's not nourished, I mean, unless it's a lower form. It's not nourished by knowledge. It means that you use knowledge, of course. Mother Jashoda is intelligent, you know, so when she cooks, she knows what she's doing. But the relationship with Krishna is not based on knowledge, it's based on attachment. Okay. Anything else? Any other question? Yes.
You mentioned earlier that the heart is claimed by hearing the pastimes of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And is there a difference between hearing directly that Brahma Shabda and reading?
Is there a difference between hearing and reading? If the reading is heard from the appropriate source, no. You know, so that's why the acharyas write books and commentaries, so that one is hearing, that is hearing. Right? Means in the other ages, then simply hearing through the ears is the most, you know, common, because everybody has a good memory. They don't have to have it written down or they'll forget it, right? But in this age, because the memory is short, things are written. So then you hear through the eyes. Right? So that's why Shastra Chakshus, you see through the eyes of Shastra, that's how you hear through that. So it's the same. But it has to be from a source that it has to have been coming, you know, from the acharyas. You know, then that works. Okay? Okay. Anything else? Okay, so we'll end here, and then we'll continue on Monday. From the appendix, Parishishtam. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jayanita Gaura Premanandi.